We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And occasionally we, as those of you who listen regularly to this program know, occasionally we like to kind of step back from the news of the day, politics and the top headlines, and kind of take a 30,000 foot perspective on what is going on culturally and in worldviews, and specifically with respect to a lot of the views that are infiltrating our families, our churches, our culture, and then infect our politics. And one of those, of course, is gender ideology, queer theory. And there's a great new book out called D-Trans, True Stories of Escaping the Gender Ideology Cult. And this is by Mary Margaret Olihan, who is a senior reporter for The Daily Signal, and she joins me now. So, Mary Margaret, thanks so much for joining and talking about this, and for writing this book that are true stories of people who have gone through the horror of buying into the trans activist queer theory, and then at some point realize that they've made a terrible mistake and they seek to detransition, and yet their stories aren't being told by the mainstream media, because you're only lauded if you go along with queer theory, but when you detransition, then it seems like you're silenced. So you're giving them a voice. So talk about how you put this book together and some of these stories.
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me on. And I totally agree, the establishment media is not interested in giving voice to these detransitioners. So it's largely been up to conservative media so far to tell their stories. And these people are many of them young people who don't really have political affiliations. They wouldn't really describe themselves as Republican or Democrat. And they're slowly realizing that some of their only allies are in conservative media. So we're very grateful to them for trusting us with their stories. When I started writing this book, I wanted people to be able to hear their stories and understand what happened to them from a storytelling perspective. So we know, for example, that there's many people throughout the United States that might say that they're left-leaning, but they don't want to trans children. They don't support allowing boys and girls locker rooms. They don't support allowing kids to get transgender surgeries, hormones, and puberty blockers. And these kind of very far-left ideas that are being pushed on them and on our kids are drawing a lot of Americans more to the right, because they just don't appreciate these types of radical things being pushed on them. And so my hope is that with this book and with these stories, people can see the realities of what it's like for a teenage girl to undergo puberty blockers and then testosterone and all of the mental and physical side effects, and then to get a double mastectomy, and to hear from her perspective what that was like. And then the moment that she realized, oh my gosh, I no longer have breasts. I can't ever breastfeed my babies. I didn't even think before today about whether I wanted to have babies. And this full realization moment of what she's been through and how she's been lied to by activists and the medical system. And so I just wanted to give them a platform to share their stories and to help people understand from a reported perspective what's going on here. Because there's many people who are smarter than I am that can commentate on this, and I hope they do. But this was an effort to tell their stories in a way that everyone can understand the realities of what a atrocity this has been.
Yeah, and I'm so thankful that you are giving them a platform. And in your reporting and speaking to these detransitioners, what has been the common theme of how they first were transitioned? I mean, was this something that was in part by their choice, or was this something that, you know, their doctors, their parents kind of pushed or maybe even forced on them? Or what's kind of the common thread of how people even get into a transition to begin with?
Right. Well, I should say, first of all, that we do know that there are very evil people who I would say are very narcissistic parents who try to transition their young kids that, you know, as toddlers out of a desire to promote themselves. And we know that that is a reality. For the people in my book, the detransitioners in my book, they stumbled upon transgender ideology online, a lot of them on social media and or through peers at school, and began to be interested in the topic largely because they were lonely. They had something going on at home, whether it was an alcoholic parent or their parents were going through a divorce, or, you know, many of these young people were on the spectrum, but they just weren't aware of that fact. And so they began to learn more about transgender ideology online. And at school, their teachers and counselors and therapists began affirming them, socially transitioning them. And when it got to the point where they began seeking hormones, unfortunately, it's far too easy to access these. And so they were able to quickly head down that pipeline. Now, they did have to have the permission of their parents if they were minors. But again, these therapists and doctors are very manipulative. And for your average American parent who is secular, who is, you know, not really practicing a faith, who doesn't really understand the intricacies of politics and gender ideology, this is quite the conundrum, because what they're being told is your child needs gender-affirming care, which sounds very positive, right? It just sounds like a nice thing. It's not. It's actually transgender surgeries, hormones, and puberty blockers for kids that are irreversible and experimental. And the doctors tell parents, would you rather have a dead daughter or a living son? And so parents think, I love my kid. I don't understand what's going on here. The medical professionals are telling me to go this way. My gut's telling me this is nuts, but I guess I'm going to trust these medical professionals. And so unfortunately, many of them did trust medical professionals and allowed their kids to go this route.
And isn't that just so tragic that we trust the experts, and we should, in a reasonable common sense society where the oaths that doctors and practitioners take is truly first do no harm, and harm can absolutely include mutilation of children's bodies. I mean, that should be a no-brainer, but that these practitioners now are pushing through saying I am the expert, pushing these parents and these kids toward life altering terrible consequences. And and I think that the law needs to reflect that and to have severe consequences in terms of liability. And hopefully some of these lawsuits that are already arising, like Chloe Cole, who is, you know, one of the more prominent detransitioners who has now been able to, at least so far in the court, successfully push forward a lawsuit in her case. That's a good thing. And I hope that eventually our law will reflect that. But then on the flip side, Mary Margaret Olhan, and her book is titled D-Trans, True Stories of Escaping the Gender Ideology Cult. You can pre-order it now on Amazon, wherever books are sold. So then what, with this social transitioning, which seems to be the gateway to get kids to socially transition and then eventually the medical consequences, what then has been the common thread in some of these stories where eventually the parents or the transitioner themselves, you know, these poor kids, they wake up and say, well, wait a minute, enough is enough, and we want to start the process of trying to wind the clock backwards?
Yeah, so unfortunately, when that moment comes around, it's usually because the young person, so let's say Chloe, for example, She's been through puberty blockers. She's been through testosterone. She's been through surgery. So she has been through all of this. And there comes a moment when they realize, I don't feel better. In fact, I feel worse, and I'm missing body parts, and my body is struggling. Because something that I get into pretty thoroughly in the book is the physical side effects of testosterone on the girls' bodies and then estrogen on the guys' bodies, which includes, for the girls, they have experienced really intense rage fits on testosterone, unlike anything they've experienced before, really increased sex drive, which is very confusing for many of these young girls. Also, changes in their bone structure, bone density, hair growth, hair loss, body fat distribution, just all of it changes. And so they're experiencing all these things at the same time. The girls often will lose their ability to cry, which is very confusing for them. They'll know that they need to cry to feel some kind of emotional relief, but it just doesn't happen. They'll lose the ability to scream, some to sing. So it's just all these things that that one might find disturbing when you're experiencing them yourself. And then I think something that I really have harped on is that many of these doctors and therapists, when they promise, when they're telling these young people about transitioning or when they're promising things, one of the promises that they make is that these detransitioners will be happier if they transition to another gender. So you will be happier living as a boy, or this surgery will make you like finally feel like okay in your body. And that's a lie. And they can't be promising that anyways. You know, happiness, if you're a Christian, obviously you believe that happiness comes from knowing, loving, and serving God. I think Aristotle even got to that point himself as a pagan. You know, happiness is something that every single man seeks. But as a doctor, promising that if you go through a certain surgery to pretend that you're another gender, that you will experience happiness, it's not just a lie, it's a brazen lie. And I find it incredibly insidious and dangerous. But these kids, you know, when you're a teenager, you believe many things. And so you're seeking identity and you're seeking happiness, and you trust these medical professionals. And ultimately, there comes a moment when you realize they didn't know what they're talking about, and now I'm missing body parts, and my body is potentially irrevocably messed up and changed, and now you have to deal with the consequences. And unfortunately, there's not very many doctors who are willing to even contemplate helping you detransition, because detransition is politically incorrect. You're not supposed to regret your transition. You're supposed to happily thrive. And the only people that would want you to detransition are those hateful Republicans and their anti-trans bills, which obviously, as I'm being facetious here, the bills that we're talking about are seeking to protect kids from this type of thing, which they cannot fully consent to. So that being said, I've spoken with many detransitioners that told me that the moment of realization for them really came when they realized that they weren't happier, when they realized that their mental health was deteriorating even more. And that was the moment for them when they thought, oh my gosh, this has all been a big lie.
Wow. And how horrifying to realize that you have been lied to. I mean, I think everyone has gone through, you know, some level of realizing that either you've been lied to or you've been betrayed by a friend or, you know, some of those things. But generally, you know, the consequences are not nearly as severe as these detransitioners are experiencing. And in just the last about minute and a half I have with you, Mary Margaret Olhan, and everyone listening, you need to get this book, Detrans: True Stories of Escaping the Gender Ideology Cult. Are we as a society, and especially the Christian church, prepared to deal with the fallout of this? I mean, there's going to be more and more of these stories.
I think that something in particular Christians could benefit from is a greater understanding and empathy for the parents. You know, we often think, how could a parent let their child go through this? How could a parent condone this? And I think something worth realizing is many of these parents are confused, and they're trusting doctors and therapists. And yes, they should be more aware, and yes, they should do more research, and yes, they should, you know, guard their children more fiercely and not allow them to go down this path. But I think we need to remember that we are living in a crazy time, and these medical professionals who we should be able to rely on are relying on ideology over science and facts. And so I think the parents that have gone through this deserve empathy, and they deserve help. You know, they deserve someone, they deserve allies that can say, your children don't have to go through this to be happy. Yeah. Here's how you can
a
help
little bit of grace, maybe.
Process.
Yeah, you know, and some help. And the church needs to be prepared for this. So Mary Margaret Olihan, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for writing this book. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back, and turning now to another false ideology. We talked about queer theory. Now let's talk about cultural Marxism and another new book called The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. And Tucker Carlson has reviewed this book, and he says this: how has our ruling class gotten away with attacking the majority of Americans on the basis of their race? The answer is scary, and this outstanding book explains. So this is by Jeremy Carl, who is a fellow at the Claremont Institute. And Jeremy, thanks so much for joining. So explain The Unprotected Class.
Yeah, well, and Jenna, thanks so much for having me on. It's really a book that I kind of looked at because I felt like this was a really pressing subject, and for understandable reasons, people were very reluctant to talk about it, that we had a rise of both formal and informal discrimination going on in a wide variety of different areas of society against white Americans. And it just had gotten to the point that kind of it was something that everybody was whispering about, but nobody was talking about. And so I wrote the book to talk about it. I kind of go from everything from looking at Hollywood to the military to healthcare to our education system, immigration, you kind of name it, and look at kind of how it manifests itself in a variety of different ways and what we should do about it.
Yeah, and this is so important because, you know, it's been very fascinating to me to, and I've increasingly talked about this on this program, where the 1960s kind of civil rights movement and the attempt then to say, you know, we should not be viewed or discriminated against on the basis of skin color, and there was this push for equality in that sense, has gotten so manipulated. And I think the Civil Rights Act, for example, has now been perverted in ways that era totally did not intend. Like, for example, the Bostock decision that read into the 1964 Civil Rights Act to say, well, sex now covers sexual orientation, gender identity, that clearly that Congress did not intend. But we're seeing this kind of new civil rights movement that is trying to frame civil rights as protections of the Constitution over and above property rights. And with that, we get this clash of rights, and increasingly the left is trying to suggest that the civil rights, and only the ones that they prefer, should be protected over basic things like right of contract, actual property rights, you know, unreasonable search and seizure. I mean, all of these things, due process, and so forth. And so, you know, this is how you get to the left arguing, for example, in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case or 303 Creative, that yes, the state can compel someone to use their creative skills and talents in their business to affirm a quote-unquote civil right or this cultural Marxist ideology that goes against not only their fundamental right as an American not to be compelled, but their sincerely held religious beliefs. And it's because of this sort of oppressor versus oppressed system that they have harnessed civil rights as a mantra to try to promulgate. And so it's fascinating to me, Jeremy, that their view of civil rights now does not include the oppressor class as they define it, which would include everyone categorically as white, or whoever they say are, white adjacent or white affirming, which could actually, in fact, include minorities. And it's so ridiculous to me. So how are you kind of shaping this in terms of, because I think the title of your book is fascinating, The Unprotected Class, because if we're truly not discriminating on the basis of race, that should include everybody.
Well, absolutely, Jen. I think you hit on the key distinction when you said only the rights that they prefer. And unfortunately, I think whatever the original intentions of the Civil Rights Act, we quickly pivoted toward just that. It was only the rights they preferred, and it was only the communities the left preferred. And if you are, kind of a member of the so-called unprotected class, and Jen, I know you're an attorney, so you recognize that language as we talk about protected classes under the Civil Rights Act, that you basically can't discriminate against. And technically, again, as you sort of allude to, whites should actually be covered under that. But what we find, in fact, in the reality is when the rubber hits the road, whites are not protected as a class. Formally or informally, they're being discriminated against kind of in plain sight. And, we see this, and we see these kind of attacks also on basic freedom of contract, freedom of association. You mentioned the Masterpiece Cake Shop case in Colorado where you have somebody being forced to bake a cake for a gay wedding when it goes against their Christian convictions. So I think we just need to kind of look. One of the things I talk about in my book is the need to really reorient our civil rights laws to kind of take into account modern realities.
Yeah, and I think that is what is so important, is that we can't allow the left to use this term civil rights, and by that essentially mean, in practical terms, cultural Marxism. And to say that civil rights are only protected in this country if you are part of the oppressed class as we define it, because then you're undermining entirely the rule of law and genuine actual equal protection under the law, not equality as the left would prefer. And so how do we get back toward affirming a true view of what civil rights should be, and especially property rights and constitutionally protected rights in this country, when, your book, as you say, the civil rights movement has increasingly betrayed that vision?
Well, I think we need to organize, and that's one of the things I talk about. And when I talk about it, I kind of put it this way. White people need to organize in their own defense, and this is not about kind of like a politics of whiteness or white people, but it's in the same way that when Martin Luther King Jr. was organizing for the Civil Rights Act, he didn't just sort of pretend that it was a group of random individuals who was being kind of oppressed under the current system at the time. He said, obviously, this is black people who are being oppressed. I'm going to organize them and allied whites and other groups to fight against that. I think at the same time, we need to sort of parallel that. So we need to say, look, white people are being given a raw deal under the current situation. We need to organize them to vindicate their individual constitutional rights to be treated in a colorblind fashion, along with allied minorities and anybody else who's willing to kind of step in. And it's only when we kind of do that type of organization and make the left realize that there are going to be political consequences for the fact that they are attempting to treat us as second-class citizens that this will change.
And how do we do that without just kind of, playing into the left's rhetoric that then would say, oh, look, now you are becoming the oppressors and you are, banding together as, quote, as white people, and you are all racist. Now this becomes this kind of us versus them sort of mentality.
Right.
And how do we do this as a group when this is about individual rights?
Right. Well, it's not what they call us. It's what we answer to. And first of all, we are going to work with anybody who supports that. And in my own work and in the endorsements of my book, I mean, to borrow a phrase from Jesse Jackson back in the day, it's a rainbow coalition of folks. I mean, I've had a number of endorsers of this book, including the longest ever serving African-American member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. So I'm not suggesting, again, that we organize this in a way that it's just white people who care about it. But it is a way of saying that white people can't accept being second-class citizens. But when we ask for that, of course, we're not asking for special rights for ourselves on behalf of the fact that we're white. If we did that, that would be a problem. What we're asking is to be treated equally under the law, that we are not going to be discriminated against. And I think that's a very, very different thing.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. And that should make sense, because if anyone has studied recent history at all, then they would know that that is exactly what the original civil rights movement was all about, that we should be judged on the content of our character, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, not on the basis of our skin. And yet what, you know, BLM in 2020 and, you know, the summer of riots and violence was suggesting was that all white people need to apologize collectively and categorically for being white. And it doesn't matter what you in your own actions have actually done with your life. It's that if you were born white, somehow you are already an oppressor, even when you're an infant, and you need to categorically apologize for your entire race and your history. And so we do need to push back against that. And I think meaningfully and in a way that doesn't just then play into their hands in that sort of way and not allow the cultural Marxist mentality to then be projected onto all of this. And so we're seeing and the subtitle of your book, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart, we are seeing that in real time, and we're seeing that still persists. And even then, with the rise of, you know, anti-Semitism, which I think is just the next kind of iteration of cultural Marxism, it's not so much that anyone on the left particularly cares about anti-Semitism, or even that they particularly care about, you know, anti-whiteness. It's more that they care about dividing people into classes. And so this is tearing America apart. And how do we advance that message with truth instead of just becoming these separate classes, which I think would then just kind of play into the left's whole cultural Marxist motif?
Right. Well, we don't want to create a new victim class here, right? And we don't want to, you know, I write this in the book that I'm trying to rally the troops here, not whine to the referees. So I think that ultimately the type of discrimination only ends, white people are not a 1% group in America. It ends when we decide that we're not going to put up with it anymore. And again, I think we need to make our what we want very clear. And again, it's not special rights that we're asking for ourselves on the basis of being white, but to be treated equally under the system. And I think, you know, implicitly, I think what you're saying is it's threading a needle, right? I mean, it's not, yeah. You know, obviously if we stand up for ourselves, the left is going to scream because they don't want to give up power. They don't want to give up their kind of cultural Marxist victim oppressor kind of dynamic that's been working really well for them. So whenever you try to take power back from somebody, they're going to scream. But I think we just have to be really clear about what our goals are, which is equal treatment, not special rights for any one group, no matter what color it is.
Yeah. And to clearly define what equal treatment means, it's not in a oppressor versus oppressed framework, but truly that everyone has equal opportunity. And so outcomes are going to look different. That is the American experiment. That's the American way. And that's just reality. I mean, we're never going to get to, you know, a perfectly distributed system, because we're not socialists, nor has any, you know, communist right. nation that's tried to do that been successful at all. And so so the book is The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart by Jeremy Carl, who is my guest this morning. And in the last about 4 or 5 minutes I have with you as well, what impact should we have in terms of trying to force some of these issues in the judiciary, because, you know, largely we've seen that some of these have been defensive, and necessarily so, like Masterpiece. But 303 Creative, in my view, was very brilliant by the Alliance Defending Freedom, who represented that content creator, because it was a pre-enforcement challenge. And so, you know, it was before she was sued and before they were put on the defensive. ADF went to the court and said, listen, we want a pre-enforcement challenge of Colorado's Anti-Discrimination Act as applied here. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court and ended up in a very good opinion for America. So, you know, how much more of that kind of work should we be doing?
In my book, I argue, Jenna, that lawfare is actually one of the core things that we need to be doing. So I think it's absolutely essential. And I think kind of the key area right now where the court has given us an opening and we should look to expand on that with more good rulings is on this affirmative action case against Harvard and the University of North Carolina that we got a very strong decision from the court on, and looking and working to expand that and make it clear that it should apply not just to university admissions but to employers as well, that we shouldn't be discriminating against based on race in that way. And understand that people need to think, in case anybody thinks that I'm sort of being overwrought here in kind of my description of what our opponents want. I mean, Ibram Kendi, who's kind of the godfather of critical race theory, has explicitly said that if you have any sort of different outcome by race, it is prima facie a evidence of racism and not anything else. And so they're going to hold us. That's their standard that they want. We have a standard where it's Thomas Sowell's The Quest for Cosmic Justice Leading to Greater Injustice. That's what we kind of understand, that you're never going to have complete equality by any group in terms of outcomes, but we are going to demand complete equality by the standards of the processes and laws that we have in America. We need to enforce those laws, and we need to expand the legal terrain that we are fighting on a great deal. And I think it's an absolutely core part of what we're going to need to win.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And Democrats are purposefully using lawfare and the process to push the outcome that they prefer instead of protecting the process and ensuring that that due process and all of the guaranteed rights that the Constitution protects are for everyone. And in that fairness and justice landscape, then we can argue and we can continue to try to advance and pursue happiness and to create a more perfect union when we have that kind of rule of law instead of this civil rights sort of view of, you know, oppressor versus oppressed that will completely reinvent America. So, Jeremy Carl, thanks so much for joining. The book again is The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. And you can get this on Amazon, anywhere books are sold. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And there is so much more to get into when we are talking about the anti-white racism that's tearing America apart. When we're talking about queer theory, when we're talking about all of these things that are antithetical to the biblical worldview. And ultimately, it always comes down to worldview, right? How do we view the world? What do we understand and interpret from the reality to which God has presented us, as C.S. Lewis would frame it? And what the left is trying to do, and this isn't just in politics and policy, but it's with, you know, the rule of law, it's with everything in society. When you talk about how doctors conduct themselves, psychologists, educators, education, universities, I mean, all of these different institutions and practices, the left is on purpose trying to push cultural Marxism instead of the Judeo-Christian biblical worldview. And this is why worldview matters. And if you have not read A Finding Truth by Nancy Piercy, she's written a lot of great books. And she is a Francis Schaeffer scholar and a Christian apologist and writes brilliantly. She wrote the book along with Chuck Colson, How Should We Then Live? And then, you know, has continued to write. And Total Truth is kind of the magnum opus of a lot of this that is very detailed. It's literally a brick. And if you want to tackle that, I would encourage you absolutely to read that. I went through the World Journalism Institute back when I was in undergrad, and because my major was journalism, and World Magazine is probably a lot of you are familiar with here in the AFR family. They have, or had at least at the time, the World Journalism Institute, which was a substantive 2 or 3 weeks. I forget how long it was. It's been a long time ago. But several weeks that you would go to. I went to Washington, D.C. They had these institutes a couple of different places in America. And you would go and learn the art of journalism. And I loved that they started out not just teaching the things that I was already learning in college, like, you know, what's the difference between you know, how an editorial piece looks like versus an opinion piece versus reporting. And there's all these different skills and parts of the craft of writing and journalism. They started substantively with worldview. Because as Joel Bells, who was the program, you know, organizer at the time, his view, and I think this is absolutely correct, was that anyone can learn how to write, but first you have to have something to say that is worthwhile to read. And that's absolutely true. And I think a lot of people have some good things to say, but have difficulty writing. And that's where the craft and the art of journalism can come forward. But in order to have something to say, we need to make sure that the substance is based in substantively truth. And that is the biblical worldview. And so Nancy Piercy was my professor at the World Journalism Institute, and I met her through this program, and I'm still friends with her to this day. And she was very influential in me writing my book, The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution, because what I had learned through not only and primarily the discipleship of my parents through homeschooling and being grounded in truth and knowledge of a biblical worldview, but then substantively also knowledge of worldview. Then when I went to the World Journalism Institute, which I think was the best portion of my college career that I ever did, was substantively those few weeks at the World Journalism Institute because of Nancy Piercy. And we went through, in 1 week, we went through her book, Total Truth, which had just come out at the time. And went through this understanding of what she describes as the divide between secular and sacred in the secular humanist view, that certain things are sacred, other things are secular, and we have this divide that largely a lot of Christians, unfortunately, have bought into, and how that worldview that is false pervades our institutions and our subject matter, like psychology, philosophy, the arts, all of these things. And the Bible teaches us, to the contrary, that all things belong to God. Everything, therefore, is sacred. Everything that we do, our work, when we go to our places of work, that all is part of what God himself has ordained. And we have to view everything that we discuss and we write about in a lens of truth. And so a few years later, Nancy Piercy wrote a book called Finding Truth. And this is a little bit easier volume because she specifically wrote it for college students to understand what are the primary philosophies or religions or religious philosophies of the world that are inconsistent with the biblical worldview, because there's either truth or there's something else, which is by definition false. And we need to, as Christians, know and understand not only the truth of theology, the knowledge of God, the person of God who is the truth, but we also need to then understand and be able to recognize and identify the false worldviews so that we can combat them where they persist in culture. And one of the things that I think the church substantively is overarchingly is falling very short on is teaching worldviews. Because even if we learn about the Bible, very good, we have to learn the knowledge of truth. With that should also come pointing out the false and empty philosophies of the world so that we can learn to recognize them. Because one of the worst things that Christians unfortunately fall into and into to traps is when we fail to recognize when a worldview that is false and inconsistent with the teachings of the Bible is being advanced or propagandized through some other artifice in society. And so it's very easy to say, here's what the Bible teaches, and that's in the confines of my church. But when I go out into the world and I see that, you know, oh, you know, why should or should not Congress vote for humanitarian aid or to have Gazan refugees come to America? Well, those are only politics and policy. And, you know, the Bible doesn't have chapter and verse for whether or not Joe Biden and his administration should have Gazan refugees come to America. So the Bible doesn't have anything to say about that, right? We've heard a lot of Christians say that. The Bible doesn't have anything to say about politics. And, you know, America wasn't even established, you know, during the days of the early church. So, you know, there's maybe some principles to apply, maybe, but the Bible doesn't have chapter and verse on this. That could not be further from the truth. The Bible says that it has given us instruction for how to live righteously. We have everything that we need in order to live rightly. And that wasn't just for the early church. That was for every Christian who would follow until the end of all things. We have the full counsel of God that is his truth. And in order to understand and recognize the every wind of doctrine and the false and empty doctrines and the conceits of this world, we have to first recognize where the doctrine and philosophy or policy principles or politics of the world are incompatible with the truth of the gospel of Christ. And in order to do that, we need to do what the law calls issue spotting. So when I went to law school then from journalism and I learned to substantively write about truth and as Joel Bells also said, journalism is the art of recording God's movements throughout history. And I love, love, love that description of journalism. And I love to write. And I went to law school then and ended up and, you know, God had a marvelous plan for me that when I thought I was going to be practicing law more substantively, God used my undergrad degree in journalism to have me speak the philosophy and the substance of the truth of the law and God as a divine lawgiver through American jurisprudence and the Constitution through journalism. And what I do now each and every morning here on AFR is basically that, is talking about the truth of God, specifically in law and policy primarily, but of course other areas and subject matters. And use my gifts and talents to then record God's movements throughout history, but explain and articulate and philosophize the truth about God as it relates to law, politics, culture, the church, and the family. And I love that. And so so as I moved to law school, then the law will and law school will teach you to do what's called issue spotting, which if for anyone who's gone through law school, you will be very aware of what I'm about to say. When a client comes to you and says, hey, I have a problem, and then they go into and they launch into their whole description of the problem, probably 99% of what they're about to tell you is totally irrelevant to what the actual legal issue is. And so taking all of that in their whole narrative and telling you things that are, you know, very important to them, a lawyer has to be able to issue spot or ask questions to say, to understand where the legal liability is, the potential risk, the potential harm, the potential outcome of either a defense case, or if they're looking to sue, or whatever the issue is, and wherever the subject matter lies, you have to be able to spot where the legal issues arise. And in order to do that, you have to be sufficiently educated in the law to be able to recognize, as your potential client is describing their situation, you have to be able to recognize the things that they don't. And that's why they're coming to you. It's the same thing as, doctors do this all the time as well, or even auto mechanics. You come in and, for me, it's like, my car is beeping at me. I have no idea what's going on. Please diagnose this. And I don't know. And I have no idea. I have no idea where to look, what questions to ask, because I have no idea how a car works, right? When I pick out cars, it has always been on the basis of cuteness and their color. That's really all that matters to me, and that they can function appropriately. If anything goes wrong, I bring them in to the experts who can issue spot, right? So we do this in every area of our lives. And I'm sure you do this at whatever job you have, or even, in homeschooling, or if you're a stay-at-home mom. And we all do this commonly. And we need to start doing this as well as Christians. Because if we fail to understand the biblical worldview and the law of God, his principles, his precepts, and the knowledge of truth, and we may have passion for God, that's great. But if we don't have the substance, the knowledge, and the instruction in righteousness, so that we may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works, what are the good works? Well, as Ephesians says, we are created by God before the foundations of the earth. He knew the good works to which we would be called. We have a calling. And in order to do that, we have to know substantively what the Bible says, what the truth is, and the biblical worldview, so that when we encounter all of these false and empty philosophies, we are not tempted to believe them. We can issue spot, and we can say cultural Marxism is wrong because that empty philosophy divides human beings into oppressor versus oppressed classes and shows partiality, which the Bible says no. And God's word says all human beings are created in the image of God, and God does not prefer or show partiality or preference or have any sort of authority structure based on race, for example. And in his authority, we can see that he has ordained certain offices within the family and within the church, and we should be under those authority systems. And so it's not an oppressor versus oppressed system. It's all about legitimate authority and limited power under God's ultimate authority himself. And so then you can see the contrast and you can issue spot. And when we're talking about humanitarian aid, we can say, okay, was Jesus really a socialist? Was he really for humanitarianism, quote unquote, as the left would say? Did he really say love is love and we should affirm everyone regardless of their choices in life? No, Jesus said, have you not read that God created them male and female? Have you not read? And he always pointed back to the truth of Scripture and affirmed everything that God gave in the moral law that was affirmed by himself, because Jesus, we understand, as God, was part of creation and himself created and is part of the divine as the lawgiver. And we have to understand all of these things. Otherwise, we can unknowingly say, I'm a Christian, but I believe that, humanitarianism is part of what the political view and policy of the government and the state should be, and it's fine to tax everyone and steal from people and to use those resources otherwise. And we won't have the view to be able to say this is an empty philosophy and it is inconsistent and incompatible with the Christian worldview. So I would suggest start with finding truth. that is a great way to be able to issue spot some of the core false doctrines. And we'll continue to talk about this more. We're already out of time for Jenna Ellis in the Morning, but you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net, and make sure that you are learning the biblical worldview of truth. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.